On today's episode, we talked to Greg Lindberg, who I've known since we were 2 or 3 years old. We've grown up in the same elementary schools and high schools. Still remain friends today. He has a visual impairment and is legally blind. So we talk about growing up with a visual impairment and also talk about our experiences together and talk about some issues that we face growing up, going through school, and entering the workforce. Hope you enjoy. I was born in Tampa, Florida, and I was raised in Palm Harbor. I actually grew up in the same neighborhood that you did. We lived down the street from each other, and I think we met when we were like 2 or 3 years old. I don't remember the venue.
Yeah, maybe three.
Yeah, I don't remember the venue that we actually met in. But
right. I think I might have been in a wagon or something, and I don't know if you were, but it was on the street, I believe. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Our parents' mothers kind of ran into each other. So.
Yeah. So, we grew up in a neighborhood in Palm Harbor, and I believe, we went to elementary school together. Now, keep in mind, we were in all separate classes. We were too feisty, I think, to put in the same class. Too much trouble.
Yeah. Double duo. Yep.
Yep. So we were in separate classes all the way through elementary school. And then I believe we branched out and went to different middle schools. I went to Carwise. I had a family member that was there working. So like I got like a special waiver to go there. I believe you went to Coachman. So, and then and then we all kind of reconvened back in high school. And again, we had separate classes, but I believe we had a few classes together, like computers and English and other classes that we were in. And then I went off to college and got a degree in computer information systems and stayed a little bit longer for MBA. And I think you went to St. Pete College, got your associates, and then you went to USF. So,
yep, USF St. Pete. And then, also got a master's in journalism there, bachelor's in mass communication.
So, yeah, we've been friends for a long time and kind of been, I guess we can call it confidants in terms of sticking together. I mean, we both have some obstacles that we have to overcome. And I think that maybe kept this friendship going because you kind of helped me out on a few things and I'd help you out on a few things. And, I would be your eyes and you would, help me out on other things.
Exactly. Yeah. That's kind of worked pretty well. Just, we each have our own strengths and I think they've kind of complemented each other. So it's definitely worked out in a lot of ways.
So one ironic thing I have to mention is, I moved over to Dade City, got married, moved over to Dade City, and then Greg, I think you were looking for a job, and after many interviews, you arrived at St. Leo University, and you were basically, a 4-minute drive around the corner when you moved there, so it was kind of like I moved to this no-name town that you were making fun of me for moving to that no one here. Knows of Dade City, and then you show up and it's basically like old times there,
Exactly. Definitely. Just, in a million years, who would have thought the two of us would have ended up in that small town, with a population of no more than say 7,000.
Yep. So
definitely ironic. Yeah. So let's just kind of talk about our challenges. And I know I've mentioned, on this podcast about how I am visually impaired and legally blind and whatnot. And if you don't mind just sharing about your condition, your challenges, and kind of what you've dealt with.
Yeah, so I was born with what they call hyperglossal, hyperdactyly syndrome. So basically it affects both my hands and my feet. And I also had some oral problems, all congenital defects. None of them are in any of my ancestry. So it just happened. And so I was born with a club foot on my right leg, and I had a missing foot on my left and missing digits on both my hands. So I have two fingers on each of my hands, and I had my tongue was basically lodged in the roof of my mouth. So they had to perform some surgery when I was like 2 weeks old to remove or extract my tongue so that it wouldn't, as I grew, it wouldn't cause any more problems. So it was easier to, you know, fix the problem when you're that small, so when you grow up, it doesn't turn into a larger problem. Then the club foot was fixed at Shriners. So luckily I was born in the Tampa Bay area, and we had a guy at our church. We went to the same church. We both did. And his name was John Shoskin, and he was a Shriner. And so everybody at church kind of knew what was going on, and he put in a recommendation. I believe at that time, Shriner, if you had to be recommended by a shrine or a Shriner to go there. And I went there and met with, I think he's now retired, but he used to be chief of staff there towards the end of my tenure there. His name is Dr. Dennis Grogan. And he's an orthopedic surgeon, and basically they kind of laid out a plan to attack, you know, my hands and my feet. They're basically an orthopedic and burn hospital. So obviously I was on the orthopedic side of things. And so they performed corrective surgery on my club foot, and basically I have a fused ankle. So I have to wear a brace around, I don't have to, but I choose to use a brace around my leg to kind of prevent the instabilities in the ankle, just provide that extra layer of protection there. And then they made some prosthetic legs for me. So I've had braces and prosthetics provided by Shriners Hospital all the way up to when I was 18. So I probably had like 15 to 20 apparatuses, if you will.
Wow. Quite a few, yeah.
And they did some bone lengthening on my fingers so that I could be able to hold pencils and just do normal everyday tasks. So I tell people that I'm just like you. The only thing I can't do is flick you off. I can't snap my fingers, and I can't stick my tongue out. But I'm just a normal dude. I can drive a car. I took pilot's flying lessons when I was 13 years old. Most recently I went to a shooting range. So I do have a concealed carry permit in Florida, which is an interesting story of how I got that. And maybe that's for a different time to share that.
Sure. Yeah. Interesting. Let's talk about, you know, just us growing up and kind of some of the challenges that we both face, say, in school. And I know myself, you know, the big thing always was, you know, kids asking me, you know, how many fingers am I holding up? And can you see me? Can you see this, that? Just, you know, kind of always picking on me in that way. That was, you know, for me, being visually impaired was kind of the big thing I got from other students.
Well, with me, you only have a 50% chance of getting the answer right. I could hold up one finger or the other finger. Maybe a third, you know, because I could hold up no finger. So, you know.
Right.
But anyway, yeah. So you have a higher probability of getting it right with me versus the other kids. But anyway, I didn't do that with you. You know, I kind of watched out for you. But
definitely, yeah.
Growing up, I think your vision got kind of progressively worse as you grew up, if I remember right. So I remember like riding bikes with you in the neighborhood. That was like one of our things. We'd come home from school. We would call each other on the phone, go ride bikes around the neighborhood. hang out with the neighborhood kids. And if that sounds foreign to you, you're probably a millennial who sits behind a computer screen and chats with people on Facebook.
Exactly. Yep. No sunshine, no outdoor activities.
We actually, like, we made forts. We had a fort in our backyard.
True. And
down the road, there was a kid or a group of kids that had forts in kind of a wooded area behind their house. And we would go over there and climb up trees and build things and just have fun.
Yeah. And I mean, as far as neighborhood kids, you know, I feel like obviously any neighborhood's going to have some bad apples or whatnot. But, you know, despite our disabilities and challenges, we still connected pretty well with other kids around us and whatnot, you know, at least in terms of the neighborhood.
Yeah. I remember a time where both you and I got picked on a lot. by this one kid, and kind of the policy on my YouTube channel, I don't name names, I just tell stories.
Right.
So there was a kind of a brother duo that one was a few years older than the other, and the older brother, we found a creative name for him, and we went around and asked people in the neighborhood if they thought he was whatever that name was. And well, the mother got a hold of that and rushed down to both our houses and basically scolded our parents. And then once the door was shut, we got high fives from our parents. So
exactly.
Kind of a taste of his own medicine type thing. And
kind of just showed, you know, the fact that they were totally behind us, our parents. I mean, they could obviously see that, okay, there was just somebody else that was picking on us, and it was not right. So we had every right to do a little something funny. I mean, it was nothing bad or anything. Have some, you know, making a joke out of it and having some fun with it.
I think we called him a cow or something like that, and the mother took offense to it. And I mean, it wasn't even a profane word. It was just, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think of all the potential other things we could have called him. So.
So, we rode bikes a lot, and I believe, we were in all different classes, so we didn't have any, like, similar homework or anything like that. So, and I think, we hung out a lot. I know you went on cruises in the summer and we basically hang out basically a few hours every day.
So, at each other's houses or just, you know, whatever. Yeah. Occasionally working on, you know, once in a while we would have a similar class in high school even before that and might have some similar assignments and kind of, you know, work on that stuff together.
Yep. So,
So I know we talked about, you know, kind of just how others, you know, perceived us. And, you know, I would say looking back, sure, there were bullies. And I think you're going to have that no matter who you are, no matter what shape, size, you know, it doesn't matter. Everyone's going to get picked on, I feel like, at some point, you know, especially growing up as a kid or whatnot. And for us, you know, having a disability, obviously, you're a little more of a target for that, so it's just going to happen. So I guess kind of advancing forward, you know, thinking back to say elementary and middle school, it seems like that's kind of when I had more, you know, more of the bullying, if you want to call it that, or just getting picked on. But I feel like once I got to high school, it was a little less, you know, there wasn't quite as much of it. I mean, it was still kind of a rough age, you know, with teenagers, but it did kind of die down, at least for me, a little bit.
Yeah, I think the student population in our high school, we knew some of the kids from elementary school, so they kind of knew what was up and what we were all about. So I think, see, my disability, or I like to call it anomalies or whatever you want to, you know, apply to it. I don't think it has a disability because it doesn't disable me from doing anything. I just find creative solutions and creative ways to adapt to, you know, whatever I'm doing. And adaption is kind of also kind of an interesting word. Adapting kind of means that you were in a state before that you were doing something and then had to change your way of doing that to, quote, adapt to do something. So I just learned how to do it my way, right?
Yeah, and I can definitely relate, you know, as someone who's visually impaired, just, you know, like you said, there you can pretty much do everything except a few things. And I'm, you know, similar in a lot of ways that aside from being able, you know, being able to see certain things well or driving or whatnot, I can still pretty much do anything just in a different way.
Yep. So to answer your question about school and growing up with that, kind of the big thing in elementary school was the PE class. So I know we had similar PE teachers, but one of the big things was run around this bus loop and the class had to wait for everybody to get done in order to go do something. So naturally I'd be the last one to, you know, finish, or, you know, you go play soccer or baseball or whatever they're setting up on the PE courts and fields. And they have a team captain, and they have to choose what people, you know, went on certain teams, or, you know, they got to pick their team, if you will.
Yep.
And I was always the last one, or the one that the PE teacher had to decide what team to go on.
Right.
And that was difficult. And I know I had a couple trips to the principal's office over that. Not that I acted out. I saw that there was some issues going on that I think a principal should know in terms of how certain staff members were conducting, you know, that type of
activity
scenario.
Or, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I can definitely relate. I mean, I will say my vision was a little better back then, and I really did not use a white cane, you know, at that point. So, you know, like, I guess we kind of talked about before, just, you know, a visible quote unquote disability versus an invisible one. You know, I, you know, might've had thicker glasses and maybe it was a little obvious, you know, that I couldn't see too well, but it wasn't quite as obvious or glaring or whatnot, you know, as maybe somebody else. So that, you know, fortunately I did have some of that, like you said, about teams, you know, being picked for a team or whatnot. And sometimes, you know, I would, you know, people would kind of go down the line and then, okay, let's have Greg at the end or so.
Yeah.
Can definitely relate on that front too. Yeah. Yeah.
So like one thing that, I noticed, about me personally is when I got to high school, kind of that whole, I would say that bullying kind of stopped in front of me. But there was a lot of back channeling going on. So like people would get invited to parties, the whole class would get invited to a party, and I'd be the one left out. And
exactly.
I would end up figuring it out because I knew some of the other kids that were invited, and, you know, they were off doing whatever. And, of course I didn't crash anybody's party or anything like that, but, you know, that was something that kind of hurt, you know, that they invited everybody in the class or the majority of the class and you're the one out. And, you know, for lack of a better term, it messed with my head a lot in terms of what was I doing wrong? Is it something I'm doing wrong? Or is it something that they're like visually, you know, they just don't want to associate with me? So all of that kind of, you know, messed with me a little bit. But I found outlets to, I found various outlets. Like one was doing computer repair and, you know, computer work that I could pour my effort into there to kind of focus my attention elsewhere and not really care about what they were doing.
Right. And I thought it was interesting what you said about just kind of the, you know, the maybe not backhanded compliment, but just a, you know, kind of bullying in a different way. I mean, when you're, say, a preteen or pretty young, it's, you know, it's more obvious as far as picking on somebody. But once you're, say, a teenager, you know, you're kind of in that starting to date age, whatnot, and it does kind of change, you know, like you were saying, just not being included in parties, or, you know, it wasn't just someone in a class coming up to you and making a comment necessarily. I mean, maybe that would have, you know, happened here and there, but it was more subtle or more done in a different way. So it did kind of change, and I can definitely relate to that too.
And then I would say as I went to college, kind of all that kind of most of it disappeared, in terms of being excluded. Now there were some other things that so there's obviously other things that fill that void there of that not being included. So I actually I made an effort. I joined a fraternity, and I was the one in the fraternity that didn't drink and was always reliable. I'd pick people up late at night and be their designated driver. And but that was a choice I had. Was I gonna focus on my studies or get drunk and party it up, right?
Exactly.
So most of the kids in college I associated with, they're all in the business school. I was in the math and computer science department, and so I would venture to say I had a little bit more rigorous academic schedule than some of the general business majors did. So I had a lot of homework and a lot of projects to complete. So.
Yeah, and in my case, it you know, I joined the student newspaper, which was a great experience, just, you know, making friends, connections through that. And we didn't really have fraternities or whatnot, but, you know, there were activities, just, you know, social activities, campus activities going on campus that I could get involved in. And kind of like you, I really noticed a difference. I mean, from, you know, elementary to middle to high, it was, you know, a little kind of baby steps, but I feel like from high school to college, there was a big difference in just how others perceived you, how they communicated with you, how they interacted with you. And it was refreshing, just, and also living in the dorm. I got to live in the dorm for 2 years and having those roommates and just, you know, folks who live around me. I mean, I could really sense, you know, even though a lot of times college kids get a bad rap and they're crazy and, like you said, get drunk or whatever, you know, big party animals, I still got the sense that I was much more accepted and that they, you know, were more willing to include me and interact with me, you know, much more so than previously.
So I think that when kind of towards my senior year of college, I certainly think that living on campus really helped.
For
And
sure.
I think that being a constant presence around people kind of helped. So I know that towards the end of college, I moved to like an apartment off campus to do my master's program, and that kind of like I had a sense of freedom, independence, if you will, but kind of leaving that sense of community kind of created a void, and some levels of depression kind of set in.
Right.
And that's something I struggle. I'll be the first to admit I struggle with depression, and I'm on antidepressants, and there's nothing wrong with it. All right. So I know there's a lot of stigma around depression and mental health, and admitting that you have an issue. And I think that that is a constant problem in today's society. What do you think?
Definitely, yeah. And I will say I have taken medication for several years myself, and like you said, it's very common, you know, whether someone has a disability or not, everyone has something. Everyone has some kind of struggle, challenge, stress, whatever it is in their lives. Some of us unfortunately have more of that than others, and you know, there's so many factors and reasons for that. And I'm totally with you. There's no shame in it. You know, there absolutely should be no shame in that, you know, any kind of counseling, medication, whatever kind of meditation, any kind of activities that can better, that can improve or at least maintain, decent mental health. I mean, it's so important to take care of yourself and look after your well-being. And if you are struggling out there and for whatever reason, I mean, seek help. It's available. It's, very, very helpful, very beneficial. And I'll be the first one to also say it was a struggle, taking that step and admitting that I did need that help. And, just
Yes.
thinking, oh my God, I am I, do I have like a serious mental issue? Is this like something that's going to affect me in such a negative way for the rest of my life? And I don't want to be considered like this nutcase, and by taking this medication or getting counseling, or
Yeah.
and I learned that that's so not true. And I think there's a lot of stereotyping that goes on still to this day, and a lot of taboo around that subject. But there's absolutely no shame in getting help.
Yep. And recently about 2 years ago, I sought help from a licensed mental health counselor, and just having someone there in your corner to offload what's going on, so your friends don't get bothered by you. But having good friends around is very important too. And just want to thank you, Greg, for being there. About 2 years ago, I actually 2 years ago to the day, I left my marital home and separated from my wife and child. There was a lot of discernment that led up to that decision, and it's for the best for both of us and our child. I think we do have a healthy relationship in terms of raising the child and going on from there. But having a good group of friends, having good solid friends that you can call on day or night. Now, I didn't wake you up at like 2 in the morning when this happened, but just to be the ear there and listen is also very helpful. And so find good friends that can you can lean on and that they can lean on you, and you can bounce their struggles off of.
Yeah, and I gotta say, likewise, right back at you. Just I appreciate your friendship and willingness to talk and about anything. And it's I feel like a lot of people look at, say, Facebook. How many Facebook friends do you have? They look at that number,
Yeah.
and to me, it's so meaningless. I mean, you could have two or three really good friends versus maybe 30 people that you call friends and maybe occasionally see here and there. But to me, it's all about having a close circle of really, good friends who truly care and are truly going to be there for you. And there are a lot of ways that you can make those connections. If someone's listening to this or watching this and is looking to, maybe make new friends or whatnot, I mean, there's so many platforms and outlets for that. And if even if it's just one other person that you can find that you can really connect with and support each other, I mean, it's so much more meaningful than having, quote unquote, 1,000 friends on Facebook.
Yeah. So, kind of from my background, around like 2014, I was living at home working in a family business, and I kind of had this epiphany around Valentine's Day of 2014 that, hey, I'm lonely and I need to go out. I need to change something about myself, meet some people. And so I signed up for a few like meetup groups online and checked them out. And I know, from someone that has, a disability or anomaly, as I call them, it's hard to break out of that shell of, being secure at home and kind of insulating yourself from the outside world. So, so I found different venues to kind of reach out and meet people. One was through Meetup, and the other one was through church and getting involved in a men's group. Greg, so What are some of the things that you do to try to break out of that insulated shell and meet people?
Yeah, I know. Speaking of meetup, there was a group at one point a couple years ago. It was actually like an adults with disabilities group, and I actually went to a few of those meetups. And you know, it was interesting because you had such a variety of, you know, individuals with different challenges. And but it was, again, just cool to make those connections and kind of being able to relate to others who maybe don't have, you know, the exact same disability or challenges you're dealing with, but you can at least talk to about that. Also, I've been involved in the American Council of the Blind, the Florida Council of the Blind, and the Pinellas Council of the Blind, which are all under ACB. And so I've been involved in that organization for about 6 years now. And that's been a huge help in terms of connecting with other visually impaired individuals, you know, not only locally, but at the state level and nationally. And, you know, again, people of all ages, abilities, backgrounds, you know, from college age students to retirees, but pretty much all dealing with some form of visual impairment. And I've gotten so many, you know, I've made so many great connections through that organization and friendships and just learning about technology, you know, sports. I mean, there've been it's been such a great thing to be involved in, again, just for that support and just really meeting people and making those connections.
Now, you actually played in the World Series, right?
Yeah, so I do play beat baseball, which I've talked about on this podcast. And so there's it's an association. It's called the NBBA, the National Beat Baseball Association. And so they've been around about 45 years now, since the early 70s. And so they have regional tournaments, and then they have a World Series annually throughout the country. It varies, you know, each year it's a different city. So yeah, I've had an opportunity to play on a couple different teams, some in Florida, one out of Athens, Georgia. And again, just the support, the camaraderie, you know, just the team building and the relationships that you can get out of something like that, really invaluable. I mean, it just, I, you know, cannot put into words how much I enjoy playing in that, not only just the actual game, but just the teammates and being able to cheer each other on and support each other. And it just, you know, I just wish, you know, I know there are activities and maybe similar sports or events or whatnot for others, you know, with other disabilities, but I just wish I could really put into words how, you know, how powerful, how meaningful being involved in something like this sport, this type of event really is, and how positive it is, just, you know, how much of a positive impact it has on myself and everybody around me.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I know, like, you played in like that many years, and it's actually kind of funny, your university that you work for actually puts on a beat baseball tournament every yeah. year. And that was actually formed before you even went there. So, like, you showed up and you're like, what's this all about, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, they've been doing it for probably over 15 years now. And I'm thinking, how the heck did they even know about beat baseball?
Yeah.
Which is still such a niche sport. And it's just, yeah, I mean, that connection, you know, at where I work, it really just nailed it home. Like, wow, this is amazing.
Yep. Yep. So let's talk about work a little bit. I don't really have any interesting stories in terms of applying for employment or going out and working for somebody else. a little bit about me. I work in a family business, and it's a computer software business. So I actually grew up around this stuff, and I just kind of got, you know, put into this position. I went to Stetson University, got a degree in computer information systems, got an MBA, and then, you know, around that time I graduated, we started up this current company I'm at, and I'm one of the principal software engineers, and I build back-end web server applications, and in mobile apps. So I don't have really any interesting interview stories or anything like that. And but I know that you've been on many interviews and you've seen how rough it is out there to go in an interview with some type of disability, and how even though there's, you know, the EEOC, Equal Opportunity Employment, that everybody says they follow, I know there's some prejudice out there that sneaks into interviews. So kind of tell me some things about that.
Sure. Yeah. So after I finished with my master's in journalism back in 2011, it took me a good year and a half to actually get a full-time job. And so I did do, you know, some freelance writing, and it's mainly, you know, content writing, content marketing, social media, that kind of thing that I've done in my career. So I did do a little of that, you know, before I actually found an internship. And so that was with a national accounting firm. They hired me on, you know, as an intern, and I did that for a few months, and then they did offer me a full-time job there. But prior to that, and then even, you know, when I did, you know, get my current position with St. Leo, definitely have had more interviews than I can count, you know, both, you know, by phone and in person. I would say the biggest kind of thing that I've learned over time, and it's, you know, it's not always a surefire way. It's certainly not going to guarantee you a job, but it can certainly help your, you know, your chances of landing employment. And the big thing is communication, just being able to communicate, you know, who you are as an individual. And then obviously, if you have a disability, what specifically that disability is, and what you're able to do in order to kind of work around that disability to complete whatever tasks or, you know, job duties are required for a job.
Yes.
So I will say I did have one experience with this one interview I went to, and there was an initial phone interview before the actual face-to-face interview. And so it was with this guy, and I did not mention on the phone that I was visually impaired, and that, you know, I came to find out.
I would say neither should you have to, you know.
Right. I mean, I will say I should have, you know, it may not have helped me get the job. I didn't get that particular job. And I don't even know if having mentioned that on the phone necessarily would have helped. But when I did walk in for that face-to-face interview, you know, I had my white cane with me and was walking in and was in this lobby. And then the guy came out, you know, the person that was going to interview me, and he was just shocked. He really was kind of speechless. He didn't know how to really even communicate. I mean, he said, "Oh my gosh, you have a white cane, so you're blind," and literally started asking me, you know, just standing in this lobby before we ever sat down anything. He was like, you know, "So how can you use a computer? How can you do this? How can you do that?" And I honestly really didn't know what to say. I mean, I had never been, you know, basically attacked. I mean, that's a strong word, but I feel like I was pretty much attacked and just, you know, before, like I said, before we ever sat down, before there was any kind of chance for a rapport to be established.
Yes.
And, you know, I know that's, you know, it definitely was an outlier. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of ignorance out there. People don't necessarily know how to, you know, immediately interact with someone who's visually impaired or a number of different disabilities that someone might have. But it really did strike me as like, wow, you know, this is probably as bad as it's, you know, going to get in that type of setting. And so just to kind of finish that story, you know, we did eventually sit down at a table and did chat. And, you know, I felt like I did as well as I could as far as, you know, kind of making my case, so to speak, which, again, I don't think I really should have had to, you know, to do. You know, it should have just been a fairly just, you know, easy back and forth conversation, as any job interview really should be. But I knew, you know, as soon as that initial interaction occurred in the lobby of that building, I knew there was zero chance that I had of getting that job. It just, it totally, you know, there was nothing I could say, there was nothing I could do to convince that individual, yeah, you know, to hire me, because I could tell immediately that there was this level of total discomfort and just lack of awareness, lack of understanding. And it just, it really, you know, it really threw me off. I mean,
there's really no legal recourse at the end of the day. I mean, you could go and get an employment attorney and go after someone, but you probably wouldn't want to work with someone like that, you know?
Exactly. And that was the thing. It really became a mutual, you know, lack of just, you know, again, no rapport, no relationship that was ever going to work there, whether I wanted it to, yep, whether he would ever want it to or not. So,
yep. I think you had another interview that you told me about where their job description was set for like a content writer or social media writer, but they omitted some other qualifications that they were looking for until they got to the interview and saw you, and then kind of put that on to you at that interview. I believe it was like Photoshop or something like that. Can you talk more about that and how that kind of arose and how you maybe navigated around that?
Yes. Yeah. I do remember that particular case, and it, you know, like you said, the, what they were looking for, what they were advertising for was totally within my abilities. And, you know, if there was anything maybe that wasn't, you know, it was easily something somebody else, you know, could have helped me do or whatnot, you know, at that particular job. And so I do remember going for that initial interview, and it, you know, it did go well. It was a panel interview, and I thought it went very well. And I actually was called back for a second interview. And, you know, they might have briefly mentioned the, you know, it was some kind of graphic design or working with photos, maybe even just like organizing photos or whatnot, something visual related to that, you know, to that job. And so the second interview comes along, and, you know, I'm definitely excited because I, at that point, had, you know, quite a few interviews before that and had never had a second interview. So I'm thinking, hey, I got a really good chance here. You know, I must be one of the top three candidates, let's just say. And so I go in for the second interview, and, you know, the main conversation is about this visual aspect of the job. And it was never, you know, might have been briefly mentioned or mm-hmm. brought up in that initial panel interview, but it was never, you know, there was never any indication that, okay, maybe this is something that Greg wouldn't be able to do, or any kind of concern expressed on their part.
Yeah.
And so in that second interview, that was pretty much the main focus of, okay, you know, basically we're going to hire you only if there's some way, shape, or form that you can do this visual task. You know, we know you can do everything else, but, you know, is there any way at all that you can do this visual task? And, you know, I tried to express the fact that, yes, you know, even if I couldn't do it necessarily myself or do the whole thing myself, mm-hmm. with a little accommodation, it would be a pretty simple fix, something that, you know, maybe a coworker or whatnot could step in and help with that. And it would be, you know, we'd be able to make it work, basically. And so I thought I made my case and came across pretty well, and was, left with a rejection email after that second interview.
Yeah, so kind of it kind of prejudiced the conversation by kind of throwing that on to you, and maybe they wouldn't have focused on that as much as in detail if someone walked in there that was, you know, fully, you know, had their full vision. And I would probably venture to argue that that task on this, you know, scale of 0 to 100% only probably entailed probably like 2 or 3% of that job, where they based that completely on, you know, some type of disability that would prevent you from doing that, you know, 2 or 3% portion of that job.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just a situation like that where it's just so frustrating, you know, someone in my shoes.
Yeah.
Thinking, okay, you know, I can do, even if it's, let's just say, 90% of this job, you know, with a little accommodation, a little assistance, you know, nothing crazy at all,
mm-hmm.
for them to be able to help me, you know, get to that 100% mark.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, you know, for whatever reason, were not willing to provide that accommodation and take me on for it.
Okay. So what... I, from my vantage point, you know, growing up with a disability and, you know, waking up every day and going that, you know, putting my legs on and walking around for the first 10 minutes is going to hurt. Kind of what goes through your mind when you get up? How do you deal with, you know, tackling each day, you know, and knowing that you're going to face adversity or face something that, you know, you're going to have to overcome, and, you know, what drives you?
Yeah, I will say, you know, fortunately, I've kind of learned over time, and I'm still learning. I mean, I feel like we're all learning every day something to kind of improve our lives or just find a better way to do whatever it might be. You know, in my case, transportation is definitely a big challenge. And, you know, just never having been able to drive, you know, having to rely on others, you know, to get me to where I need to go. So, you know, I would say just transportation to and from work. I do work in an office, so I do have to be there at a certain time and leave at a certain time. And, you know, fortunately, over time, I've made connections, let's say, with my current job, with coworkers or neighbors or just folks who live, you know, in the area. You know, to be able to find reliable transportation, but there definitely are days where, you know, I might have a driver scheduled and for whatever reason, I never hear from them. And especially in the morning, you know, when you obviously kind of have your morning, you know, outlined in your mind about, okay, this is what I'm going to do this, you know, I'm going to get ready and then I'm going to walk out the door and they're going to be there to pick me up. And there have been several times where that has not happened. And it's like, whoa, you know, this, I got to get to work. You know, what do I do next? Who do I call? You know,
yeah.
If I try calling the driver, okay, you know, occasionally they'll pick up and they'll say, hey, you know, I forgot about it. Something came up, blah, blah, blah. You know, either I'll be able to come in a few minutes or can't come at all, or, you know, I'll call someone and they won't answer at all. Text them, nothing. And it's just radio silence. And it's like, mm-hmm. okay, then it's like, all right, you know, let me call a taxi, let me call an Uber. And it can be very frustrating. And I will say, you know, situations like that, it does throw off your whole day. I mean, it's, you know, to some, it may not seem like much. And fortunately, where I work, they're not too strict on, you know, when I necessarily get to the office or whatnot. But it's still aggravating, and it does still kind of linger in your mind even as the day goes on. And it's like, you know, you, like I said, you kind of have this outline in your mind about, okay, here's what I'm going to do today, and here's where I'm going to be, here's where I have to be at this time and that time. And if it doesn't go right, it can be very frustrating. So
yes. I know that. You get around awesome. I know that some counties, we both lived in the same counties, basically Pinellas and Pasco. And I know some counties have much more sophisticated infrastructure in terms of dealing with people that are have mobility issues in terms of, you know, not being able to drive a car or, you know, or whatnot. Can you talk to me about what you see the differences are, and maybe, I think we grew up pretty much in an urban area, but we do have a lot of infrastructure around, and then we moved out to a kind of, I would say, a country area, and those challenges that you kind of talked about earlier are adversely, you know, affected by where you live, right?
Definitely, yeah. You know, public transportation obviously is something that so many people rely on if, you know, someone can't drive for whatever reason that may be. And so I will say in Pasco County, where I currently live, the public transportation is limited. It's, you know, there are buses, there are, you know, certain forms of that transit, but it's very limited, especially where I do live in the county. And that there also are, you know, these paratransit services, which is basically a door-to-door, you know, almost like a taxi or an Uber service that the county provides at a very low cost, you know, to the rider. And unfortunately, in Pasco, that's also very limited. They only take you to what they call life-sustaining trips, or, you know, on life-sustaining trips, which does not include work. And I would argue that, hey, you know, in order to sustain and maintain, you know, wherever you're living or whatnot, I mean, you kind of need income, and you kind of have to, you know, it is a life-sustaining activity going to work every day and doing that. So, you know, that's definitely a challenge. Whereas Pinellas County, where I do occasionally go to my parents, and you know, still I am still a member of this DART program, which is also a paratransit service. And so with the DART program, they will take you literally all over the county, anywhere, for $4.50. I mean, one way. And it's and we're talking, you know, 30, probably 35 miles from north to south. It's a long county. So
That's pretty good.
yeah, and they're really, I mean, there are a few limitations on bus routes, and you know, if you live within a certain distance of a bus route, maybe they won't pick you up here or there. There are some limitations, but in general, it's pretty good. I mean, then, you know, it's 7 days a week. There are certain hours. It's not a 24-hour service, but you know, it's again, they would take me to work. They would take me, you know, to the bowling alley, to a restaurant, to a bar, you know, any friends have, I mean, literally a doctor's appointment. And so that, you know, unfortunately, there are, you know, quite a few counties out there that are more populated do offer a service like that, but there are counties like Pasco and a number of others where it's just so limited and, you know, can be very challenging, especially if you are working and, you know, have a regular place to go throughout the week.
I too. Give a little bit of understanding to our viewers and listeners here. The density of Pinellas County is very dense. It's pretty much built out, whereas Pasco County is more rural. Kind of the if we look at a map, we have Pinellas and Hillsborough that are kind of on the same county line, if you will, on a latitude. Latitudinally speaking with each other, and Pasco is above both of those counties. So, as urban sprawl grows out, we have more and more building happening in southern Pasco and more the western side of Pasco. But there's a lot of farmland, a lot of open spaces over on the eastern side of Pasco where Dade City is and St. Leo. So, I would think that probably the revenue of you know, as houses get developed, the taxation revenue probably will increase, and they will probably be able to build more infrastructure going forward. So it's not I think maybe you would agree it's not necessarily knocking Pasco, but it's I think it's a revenue issue in the long run, being able to sustain, travel long distances where you have a county that is very separated.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like you were saying, Pasco, it definitely has its pockets of population and continues to grow pretty rapidly in certain areas, but it is much more spread out. And whereas Pinellas, you do have, you know, people pretty much everywhere from head to toe, so to speak, throughout the county. And yeah, it's, you know, I certainly can't blame or say anything negative against, you know, any location, you know, city, county, whatever it may be. Because obviously, they're, doing what they can with the money and the revenue that they do have to provide those services. And like I was saying before, fortunately I have made quite a few connections. So, living in such a rural area like Dade City, I feel like if I can make it there, I can make it anywhere, kind of to borrow a Sinatra line there.
Yeah, it's a good litmus test of being able to see if you can self-sustain in an area that is pretty rural, and basically you could, like you said, you could live anywhere if you could live there. Maybe not like, rural mountaintop Alaska, but
Oh yeah, right. Obviously within a little reason here, And I will say, my goal is to eventually wind up in a place where I can take, buses, subways, public transit, and not necessarily have to rely on just, private individuals or even taxis, which can be really expensive, or even Uber and Lyft, which, hey, I mean, it's certainly a reduced rate compared to what you might pay for a taxi or that kind of thing, but can still add up.
I would venture to say that Uber or Lyft don't really have any programs for rural passengers like yourself, and that might be an area that, from a publicity standpoint, a PR, public relations standpoint, that they could offer a reduced rate for, people in rural areas that have mobility issues that qualify.
Definitely. I think that could be a huge market for them. Because hey, let's face it, even though this country has what, 325, 330 million people in it, there's still many areas that are rural and just are not connected very well at all, if at all, to public transportation. And so yeah, that would be, really a really good potential down the road.
Well, we're coming up on 1 hour here, and we're gonna close this out. I appreciate you coming on my show, and Greg, I appreciate you being long-term friends, and we'll get together for another beer one day, and hopefully we can just hopefully this has been educational to the listeners and viewers here, and what it is like to go day to day with a disability, and kind of navigating your way through life. And I appreciate your time, Greg.
Likewise, very well said. Thanks, Joe.
Greg, how can we hear more about you and hear more interviews on your podcast?
Sure, yeah. You can follow me on Twitter at Greg the Writer. That's at GREGTHEWRITER. And then you can also just Google Eyes Free Sports. So that's EYES and then FREE, two words, sports. And find that on your favorite podcast app.